Welcome once again, folks, to All Things Trek.
Here on allthingstrek.com. It's kind of repetitive to say that, but I feel like I have to.
I know, right? It's now, like, there needs to be something there.
We can't just say, welcome to All Things Trek.
Welcome to All Things Trek and allthingstrek.com, where we do All Things Trek.
In fact, we do. And so today we are going to be talking about the in-universe events surrounding and during, both before and after, Star Trek VI, because that was a very pivotal moment.
You almost said pitiful.
Pitiful? No, Star Trek V was pitiful.
I could have sworn I heard pitiful come out of your mouth almost.
No, don't believe it. It's a lie. But it was a very pivotal moment in the Star Trek universe.
Heck yeah, it was.
Both in terms of the fan base and the franchise, and just for the in-universe happenings and goings-on, because what happened at the Kittimer Peace Conference would affect TNG, DS9, and even Voyager, I guess, to a lesser degree.
That's right. But how's life going so far?
Well, things are going pretty well. Star Trek RPG is taking form. I'm swamped with players. I have my choice of players.
You're not sure about that yet, though.
Well, I suppose it's possible that it's in theory possible that I might not have as many players as I think. But I think I'm probably going to end up having to split the game into two bi-weekly meetings instead of once a week.
Like four players each?
Yeah, something like that. Because I can't run more than six.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm actually surprised. Apparently there are a lot of people who think six is like too many and won't run more than four or five.
I comfortably run four myself.
Four?
Six is stretching it for me when I GM stuff.
I'm okay with six, if only because with four, if one person doesn't show up, then I only have three, and three can be problematic. I can do three, but it's tough. But anyway, that's taking shape. I don't know if Bob told you guys, but he's going to play a Catman.
I am going to play as a Catman. Those that are familiar with the animated series, Acacian.
Those were
I'll be playing as.
I wasn't going to allow them, but it was pointed out to me that they were also in Star Trek IV.
They were.
And they looked pretty cool in Star Trek IV, whereas in the animated series, they're just, like, you know, slinky cat people. And, you know, I don't got a problem with cat people in general, but I don't like it when they're drawn specifically to be sexy.
I'm not going
to
use that stupid accent, though, that they use. They do. Well, did you ever watch the animated series?
No, I didn't. Okay. No, I watched the one episode.
So the Cation that's in there, the female Cation,
mm-hmm.
and it's very much the cartoonized, like, cat talk, you know. You know, adding a lot of that into how they talk.
Yeah, you don't do that.
There are a lot of that kind of hiss or so, whatever you want to put in there, but I refuse to talk that way, because it's really dumb, and no one will understand what I'm saying.
Please don't. I'm not
going to happen.
I don't want to take away XP, but I'm only going to give my players bonus XP if they act more Starfleet. Like, if they go through an entire session without firing a phaser, they can totally get a bonus XP.
That's right.
And if they do stuff like, you know, boldly go where no one has gone before and seek out new life and new civilizations.
I look in the broom closet.
There's a mold colony in there. That kind of counts.
I catalog it.
But, anyway. So just as a note, I do apologize if there's any background noise going on, because it is really hot today, and we can't bring ourselves to completely close all of our windows and doors.
Yeah, it's pretty warm.
So we're just going to have to deal with it.
I like airflow.
And we're going to soldier forth. And just as a primer, because since mainly we're talking about in-universe stuff today, although there'll be a little bit of just talking about the franchise in general, but we're going to be tossing around the word retcon. A fair bit. I wanted to make sure everyone knows what retcon means. Retcon stands for retroactive continuity. It is when an author or someone involved in the creative process decides to change established materials no in-universe reason.
No in-game reason. No
reason. And basically just pretend it was always that way. And sometimes retcons can be tricky because, like, you don't always know if it's a intentional retcon, or if it is or if it's just a goof, like they just messed up.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, I love to use Voyager for retcons. In The Q and the Gray, Q specifically, the whole point of the episode is that Q wants to have a kid with Janeway because he thinks that will fix the Q Civil War, and he very specifically points out that there has never been, no Q have ever had children before, as far as they know. This may or may not be a retcon, because there was an episode that, in fact, my brother is watching right now with a character called Amanda Rogers, and I cannot remember the name of that episode. I feel silly for not writing that down. But anyway, with a character named Amanda Rogers, who was actually the child of two Qs, and the whole episode is about whether or not she's going to choose to stay human or go back to the Continuum. And so it's hard to know if that was an intentional retcon, like if Amanda Rogers isn't canon anymore, or if that was just a goof. And whoever wrote that episode just didn't know about the Amanda Rogers episode.
Well, I'd be inclined to say goof.
Yeah, I'm more inclined to say goof, especially because that episode was written by Kenneth Biller, who is probably one of the worst writers on Voyager. Like, you know, Brandon Braga is not a great writer, but Kenneth...
Don't pull any punches, Orin. Don't pull any punches.
But Kenneth Biller is just awful. Like, Brandon Braga has at least written some good things. I don't think Kenneth Biller has written anything good. But, you know,
ouch.
But maybe he has. I don't have an exact biography of him. I just know that, in general, he's not very good. He was the one who wrote Twisted, which is a really, really terrible early episode of Voyager. But anyway, that's probably a goof as opposed to an intentional retcon. Bob, can you think of an intentional retcon that we can use as an example?
I'm way too into the Trek universe to admit that there are retcons.
Oh dear. This is going to be difficult then, Bob. I don't know what we're going to do about that. But I'm sure one will come to us eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so Star Trek VI. Give you a brief outline of the events.
Directed by Nicholas Meyer, who directed Star Trek II.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Both of which, in my opinion, the two best movies of the Star Trek franchise. I'm actually kind of strange in that I like Star Trek VI more than Star Trek II. Granted, I do love me some Khan. But I prefer Star Trek VI, if for no other reason than because I feel Star Trek VI is more edgy, I would say. It's like, it's doing something, like, that I think is, in the long run, has more impact. Now, and again, this is not a criticism.
There are broader implications other than Kirk dying,
yeah,
and the Enterprise being destroyed.
Yeah, and you know,
Genesis Device.
To be absolutely certain, I love Wrath of Khan. I think it's really, really good. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. But I just like Star Trek VI a little bit more. Even though Star Trek VI has some hilarious goofs in it. But the basic plot is that... Here's a good retcon. I just thought of one.
No.
Okay, so the guy who plays Tuvok, Tim Russ. Tuvok is a Vulcan.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Russ also played a character, one of the extras in Star Trek VI on the Excelsior Bridge. That was Tim Russ.
He did?
But he was a human.
I thought it was Generations he did that on the Enterprise.
Nope, it was Star Trek VI, Enterprise, Star Trek VI, The Excelsior. They actually had that was Voyager's 40th anniversary episode, was a flashback to The Excelsior, and they were like, hey, Tuvok was totally on that ship, and he was a Vulcan, and that was Tim Russ's character. That was a retcon. Now, that's a good retcon, personally. I think that was fine. I wasn't terribly invested in Tim Russ's extra character in Star Trek VI being a human, and it wasn't like it compromised the story in any way. And they, you know, made a fairly good episode out of it. But that's an example for retcon. That's an intentional choice to change something. But, yeah, totally Star Trek VI.
Okay.
So, speaking of the Excelsior, the movie basically opens with the Excelsior, gets hit by a giant space explosion. Although, it's kind of funny, because it's this huge explosion, but, like, when you actually see it, it's like a ring. It's a flat explosion going outward. So Excelsior could have avoided just by going up or down.
Nah, we all exist on the same plane, bro.
And when you think about it, the chances of Excelsior being hit by that ring are pretty slim. So
no, that's cool.
Yeah, yes. And that turns out to have been the Klingon moon Praxis exploding. Which is a pretty monumental feat, getting a good-sized moon to explode.
From overmining.
Yeah, apparently caused by overmining. Makes me wonder what they were mining over there. I mean, I guess they never actually tell us what they were mining. They just say it was their key energy production facility. And they never tell us what it was producing exactly. It may have been dilithium.
Is dilithium explosive, though?
Not that I knew of. I know that it can, like...
It's a crystal.
Yeah, in the Star Trek universe, dilithium isn't inherently explosive, but, like, it can enhance and amplify energy somehow. I mean... Scientifically, I have no idea how that would work, but that's supposedly what it does in Star Trek.
Moving off that theory, maybe they use some explosives and whatnot, some antimatter explosives, and then just went boom.
Yeah, that's possible.
Like hell of a boom.
I guess maybe they just mined the moon out to the point where its structure was so fragile it couldn't hold together anymore. Although that wouldn't exactly cause the explosion that we saw.
That's a pretty gnarly explosion.
Yeah, that was an explosion that reached all the way from the Klingon homeworld to the Excelsior, which was on, like, the border of the Klingon neutral zone. And, you know, this is a pretty big explosion. And, of course, there's also the fact that this explosion was clearly traveling faster than light, which brings up the question, how could they see it coming if it was going faster than light? But, you know, whatever. This is an analogy for the Chernobyl explosion, for the Chernobyl disaster.
Really?
Yeah, totally.
Huh, I never thought about it like that.
Yeah, that was one of the things Leonard Nimoy specifically wanted when he went into it. He wanted to do the wall coming down in space. And, like, the Chernobyl disaster is one of the events that is sort of...
Well, I knew it was a, you know, it's sort of an expose on that, sort right. of, is what it was. The, like, the USSR falling apart and whatnot. I didn't put the connection together to Praxis and Chernobyl, though.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. But regardless, whatever it was they were mining on Praxis made it explode, which makes me think maybe they should put that in their torpedoes instead of their engines. But the end result is that the Klingon homeworld is all messed up, and they need Starfleet's help to fix it because they don't have the resources. And so, you know, we have this historic opportunity for peace. And there have been a couple of, as far as I know, purely fan-based speculations that Praxis may have been intentionally sabotaged, may have been some kind of black ops operation, which I find kind of unlikely, mainly because the only organization within the Federation that is capable of that sort of thing is Section 31, which, like, timeline-wise, from an in-universe perspective, did exist at that point, even though out-of-universe they hadn't invented it yet. But Section 31 just doesn't seem like the kind of organization to do something that blatant, because their entire advantage lies in their secrecy, and so it seems very unlikely that they would just go around blowing up moons, because if you
well,
do
how
that,
would you know it would be Section 31, though, if they did mm-hmm. do it?
Well, who else in the Federation would do it?
Why not Starfleet Intelligence?
You know, Starfleet Intelligence, I can't see Starfleet Intelligence ever sanctioning an operation like that, because Starfleet Intelligence is, you know, it's still it's an intelligence organization, but it's still bound by the rules and the morals of the Federation.
when do these organizations ever play by the rules ever?
Well, I mean, that's the whole reason that Section 31 exists. Like, that's Bashir and Sloan have this conversation where Sloan is like, "Yeah, Starfleet Intelligence is cool and all, but their hands are tied because, you know, they got to be goody goody all the time." Whereas we do what we want.
I feel they say these things, but I think that they bend the rules behind everyone's backs anyway.
Yeah, well, bending the rules is one thing. Causing
Section 31 just doesn't have a rule book, period. I think that's just the difference.
Right, right. I mean, bending the rules is one thing.
Starfleet Intelligence has a rule book, but they don't abide by it necessarily all the time.
Yeah, but like blowing up a moon of like the Klingon capital that caused this huge explosion, which I'm certain killed millions of Klingons. It's like, that goes a little bit beyond bending the rules. That's a pretty horrific thing to do, and I just can't see Starfleet Intelligence doing that. Especially not without extremely dire circumstances.
Well, you gotta find out it was them first, which looks like they didn't.
No, I guess not.
If this whole theory is even true.
Yeah, but anyway, this is just some fan speculation I was commenting on.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, there's the... After they agree to have peace meetings, there's this plot to assassinate the Chancellor, to start a war... And Kirk gets framed for it and goes to Ruripente, and we see another little awesome parallel, because Ruripente is a parallel for the Siberian prisons.
Gulags.
Yeah, and we find out that the Klingons do not mess around with their prisoners.
Nope.
You go to the ice planet with giant dogs that will rip your face off.
Yep.
And a shapeshifter, which I thought was a little weird. I'm honestly not sure who that shapeshifter woman was supposed to be. Like, was she supposed to be a founder? I don't know. Are there other shapeshifters besides founders?
Well, she may have been one of the 200.
That's it 200 possible. Or 100? I think it was 200. I don't remember the group that Odo was a part of. That's possible.
I mean, Kirk says that I thought your people were mythical, or so, whatever it is. So it makes sense that since there are 200 of them scattered around the galaxy. Galaxy is a big place for just 200 beings.
Nah, man. Nah. Galaxy crowded. Super crowded galaxy.
I mean, they were sent out a long time ago, right? So
yeah. And, like, Odo is, like, supposedly, because of the wormhole, Odo is the first one to get back to them. So, yeah, that would make sense. I could see her being one of the 200. All right. I'll just go ahead and assume that's the case. And then, of course, you have, after they get freed, there's the big climactic battle with the cloaked bird of prey that still shoot while cloaked. And then they save the president, which is funny because, like, Kirk jumps in front of the president, but, like, the shot misses. Like, if Kirk hadn't jumped in front of the president, it probably wouldn't have done... Like, unless maybe... I guess maybe the sniper intentionally jerked his aim aside not to hit Kirk, which I guess is possible, but...
I think that's really just the way that it was cut and it kind of looked that way, but the intention was that Kirk pounces the president and thus the president is knocked over and out of the way of the shot is how it was supposed to play out.
Yeah, but it's like the shot actually fires while Kirk is in the air.
Well, yeah.
So, that's a little bit weird.
I think it was just bad editing.
Right. But so anyway, that's the film in a nutshell. And if you haven't already seen it, I definitely recommend going and getting it.
I hope so. That's 20 years ago now.
I think it's on Netflix now.
Is it?
I think so.
Along with Voyager, Enterprise, and
TNG. Everything except DS9. Why is there no DS9 on Netflix? I want it so bad. Even though I have all the DVDs. DS9
is too cool for Netflix.
Too cool for this school. But yeah, go see it if you haven't already. So, anyway, the ramifications for this are interesting to contemplate, because it seems as if the Federation and the Klingons have finally made peace. That's what they're talking about. They're talking about disarmament along the neutral zone, and, you know, the end of the arms race, and it's going to be, you know, this big shift.
No more Cold War nonsense.
Yeah, no more Cold War. End of the Cold War. Cold War is over. And that seems to be the biggest ramification. However, that all gets a little bit fuzzy when you take into account some of the TNG episode, Yesterday's Enterprise, in which we discover that without the intervention of the Enterprise C at the Battle of Narondra 3, the Klingons and the Federation go to war, which indicates that their relationship is still kind of rocky. And the Narondra 3 is about 50 years after, in fact, I think exactly 50 years after the events of Star Trek VI. And so from looking at that, my assumption on that was that the Klingons, like, after Star Trek VI, maybe a more opportunistic administration comes into power, because, you know, the movie ended with Chancellor Azad Bor, who was all for the peace process, but I don't know how you become High Chancellor exactly.
So a Boris Yeltsin character, if you will?
Yeah, basically. And I'm guessing that I'm guessing that whoever was Chancellor after her was less keen on this whole peace process deal, and, like, renewed hostilities with the Federation. And in fact, that actually kind of parallels U.S.-Russian relationships today, because, like, after the Soviet Union fell, we had this brief period where we were all friends with the Russians, because we were done being Cold War enemies, and now we are back to this mutual animosity with, you know, with Putin and his government.
We don't really have an arms race going on, though.
No, we don't have an arms race, but we do, our relationships have definitely chilled, because, like, you know, for various reasons. And I think that's a hilarious, unintentional parallel. And, of course, I think out of universe, the reason for this happening is that Yesterday's Enterprise was made, came out in 1990, which is a year before Star Trek VI, and what probably happened was that, you know, Yesterday's Enterprise came out, and the people making Star Trek VI were like, if they even watched it, they were like, well, we're already, like, you know, a year into making this movie, we're not going to completely change everything because of an episode of TNG, we're just going to let it ride.
Yep.
The fans can sort it out, which is ironically exactly what we're doing.
Exactly what we're
doing.
So
they, you know, good shot, good decision on that one. So yeah, that was my interpretation. Was that in the 50 years intervening, they had a brief period of friendliness, and then afterwards it started to go downhill. And without the without the Enterprise C involved, eventually, you know, you can't expect two powers that have been blood enemies for over a century to just suddenly make up.
And, definitely not.
Yeah, and so that's an interesting ramification. Bob, you want to talk about something?
No, I think that's pretty much a pretty accurate assessment so far of what has transpired. I mean, I definitely would like to have more details. I mean, especially just in general, more details of what happens between, like, 2300 and 2360.
Yeah,
just,
in fact.
Like, period. Like, a good example of that is the Tomeda incident. They say, oh man, the Tomeda incident, where we had the Treaty of Eldoran.
What is
no cloaking device.
But what is
can't
a Tomeda?
Can't be United Federation.
Yeah.
And there's, like, thousands of people died. It's like, okay, well, what happened?
Well, there's,
just in general.
I looked this up earlier. There is a novel, which is not, you know, real canon, but it's someone was trying, that it explains that the Tomeda incident, was a Romulan warbird accidentally colliding with a Federation outpost at, like, high warp, because their warp drive ruptured. And if you remember, Romulan warp drives are powered by tiny black holes.
Yep.
And so that black hole exploded and became a full black hole for a few seconds and sucked in everything, and thousands of people were killed.
Oh my goodness.
However, I haven't actually read the novel, but the plot synopsis indicates that that was all staged somehow. Like, there were no actual Federation people there. It was just, like, a big show. But regardless, without reading the novel, I can't say more, but I don't understand how that would explain the Treaty of Algeron, because, like...
Maybe the station was cloaked.
I guess that's possible, but, like, I always assumed that the Romulans, that the Treaty of Algeron brought, like, was made after some kind of really intense military conflict. After which, and the Romulans, I assume, gave up a lot. In fact, the most logical explanation that I could think of was that the Romulans launched an attack on the Federation and advanced into Federation territory and captured a large number of Federation worlds, and then decided that they didn't really want to bother occupying all these worlds, offered peace, and as a condition for giving back all of these planets, they were like, you will never develop warp drive. You will never, excuse me, not warp drive. You will never develop cloaking devices.
No more warp drive, Federation.
No more warp drive. You will never develop cloaking devices. Because, I mean, unless the Federation ambassador is a complete idiot, whoever was negotiating at the table, the Romulans would have had to give up something pretty substantial to make up for never developing cloaking technology.
Uh-huh.
Or alternatively, maybe the Romulans just threw that on there as an extra and always assumed that the Federation would develop it anyway, because that's what they would do. And the Federation was like, no, we have to stick with this treaty, guys. We said we were gonna. That would be kind of funny.
But speaking from Star Trek VI, you know, onwards from there, I mean, I definitely think that was, there was crisis, went to crisis mode. Klingons like, oh man, we need some help. Our moon exploded.
Yeah.
Our atmosphere is all messed up. We need some help here. And Federation, being the benevolent body it is, saw the opportunity for peace and went ahead and made that happen. Now, once that's all said and done, and Quonos gets evacuated or whatever, and all that good stuff, and...
Quonos? Sorry,
Q-O-apostrophe-N-O-S, Quonos.
But it's pronounced Kronos. It's spelled...
That's because it used to be spelled K-R-O-N-O-S.
Right. And then they changed the spelling to something really goofy for some reason.
They did.
But it's pronounced Kronos.
I speak English in America, so...
Look, the Q is a weird letter, okay? It does what it wants.
Quonos.
Okay, you can keep calling it Quonos.
I
if
will
you
keep
want.
Talking.
Then we can go kill
Quonos.
The Wabbit.
People on Star Trek Online call it Quonos.
Well, that's because everyone on Star Trek Online types.
No, like the developers and such.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, they need to go watch the show. That's not what it's called. Hey guys,
we're living in the future where we call
it Quonos.
Hey guys,
I'm going to call it the Benterprise.
Benterprise.
Why? Well, I think it should be pronounced that way.
Just
but
put a B
but
on there.
But
it's
not.
It had a silent GH on the end while we're at it. But yeah, and I don't know if it was a more opportunistic chancellor that came along or whatnot, or if it was just elements within the Klingon government itself that decided to go ahead and get greedy and whatnot, but we hear in the Outer Space Enterprise that around 2343, when the Enterprise was fighting...
2344, actually.
2344?
Mm-hmm.
Is that it? Okay. So, that Lieutenant Castillo is saying that they're negotiating a treaty with the Klingons when they were leaving.
So
right.
Maybe what it is it's that because we know that the peace treaty that we know that they were given that the Klingons were given a 50-year timetable to fix the problems they were having on Kronos because of the Praxis explosion.
Right.
And if you look at the timeline, 2344 is exactly 50 years after Star Trek VI. So what is possible is that the peace treaty that they originally signed with the Klingons in Star Trek VI at Camp Khitomer was set to expire in 50 years, and they were going to renegotiate a new treaty.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole Narendra 3 debacle happened, and according to Memory Alpha, and I don't know where exactly they got this, but according to Memory Alpha, it wasn't even just that the Enterprise-C didn't intercede to help their colony, it was that the Enterprise-C showed up and then, to all intents and purposes, ran away.
Right.
And I could see that. I could see the Klingons interpreting that as that's an act of cowardice. These guys aren't worthy to be our friends. So that would make sense to me. Is they were in the middle of renegotiating the treaty, and then this whole thing, and then this debacle happened and sabotage negotiations. I could see that being a thing.
Well, it'd be interesting. I'd be interested in knowing how it escalated from there. If they're negotiating a treaty, what articles are, is the Federation, is a Federation starship bound to protect a Klingon colony?
Well, I'd imagine it was more of just a Klingon honor code thing, where, like, I imagine what happened was that the Klingons were, like, probably would view it as, well, this ship showed up, and it was, like, ready to fight, and then it left because it saw that the odds were too high, and I could see from a certain Klingon perspective that would be worse than just not showing up at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, it's not even so much that you're not interested in this battle. It's that you were interested in this battle and you thought you could win, and then suddenly after you realized you can't, you're like, run away.
Oh my god!
And I could imagine a Klingon seeing that pretty bad.
Well, three warbirds versus an ambassador class.
Four warbirds.
Was it four?
Yeah, four warbirds.
Four warbirds versus an ambassador class. I mean,
yeah, I did this in Bridge Commander. It doesn't last very long. It
doesn't last.
You're actually lucky if you get any shots off because like the four. Granted, in Bridge Commander, the only warbird is the D. Derridix, which is not the warbird.
Well, I imagine it was some earlier version.
Yeah, which is not the warbirds that the Enterprise C was fighting. But regardless, the opening volley from four of those warbirds just destroys an ambassador. It's just it's just done. Like, you get hit, and then you're just dead. And there is nothing you can do about it.
Yep.
But speaking of... this is why I'm running my game in this time period. Because from, like, basically 2293, which is Star Trek VI, to, like, the start of the Next Generation, we know almost nothing about what was happening in that time period, because there...
Except what's, like, written in, like, non-canon books.
Yeah, and the occasional reference. Like, we know that Scotty went missing a year after Star Trek VI happened, and...
That was in Kirk.
Yeah, apparently... I was actually really surprised. Apparently, Generations... the start of Generations is 1 year after... the end of Star Trek VI. It's like, it's just 1 year later, and I was like, huh, I expected it to have taken longer, but that's primarily because William Shatner obviously aged a lot between movies, so it was really weird for them to tell me, no, it was only a year. I was like, oh, really? 1 year, huh?
Yeah, totally legit.
Super legit. And so, you know, we know that both Scotty and Kirk went missing and were presumed killed in that year, so that was not a good year for Federation heroes.
No.
And then we know about in 2346 that was when the Romulans attacked Worf's home. Was it Kittimer? Yeah, it was totally Kittimer.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, and it's kind of weird because that's 2 years before that's 2 years after the Battle of Narondra 3 with the Enterprise C. But Worf claims that during that time period, the Romulans and the Klingons were supposed to be allies, which is like. Again, I think this was clearly just...
When does he say that?
It's in the episode with... I don't remember what it's called, but they go to that planet that's like all crappy and full of like lightning storms, and Geordi gets stuck there with a Romulan. What is that episode called? I don't remember, but it's the first one...
Something Enemy?
Yeah, it's the first one where we meet Commander Tomalak. And it's the one where they have a dying Romulan on board, and Worf has like... some substance in his body that I forget what they called it, but basically he can give the Romulan a transfusion that will save his life, and he doesn't want to because he hates all Romulans. And I actually really liked that part. I thought that was interesting, and I was glad that they didn't just like magically fix his relationship to Romulans. But he claims in that episode that the Romulans attacked Kittimer when they were supposed to be the Klingons' allies, which seems kind of strange considering they also apparently launched a surprise attack on the outpost at Narondra 3 2 years earlier. Which maybe Worf just has his history mixed up. And that episode is even after yesterday's Enterprise, which makes it really funny. So I assume that's a goof. And that I could definitely buy that the Klingons and the Romulans were allies before Narondra 3, and maybe the dates are just a little confused on that. In my own timeline, I imagine...
Well, it may have been that, like, the Romulans come along, blow up the Enterprise C, destroy the outpost, and no one knows about it for a while.
That's possible.
And then launch the attack on Kittimer, and then people know about it.
Yeah, maybe the Romulans... Right. That's actually an interesting idea. Maybe the Romulans jammed all communications from Narondra 3, and as far as the Klingons know, it just disappeared to one of the many...
Well, it just got attacked, you know, and... Yeah. Which, actually, come to think of it, if they go there and they find wreckage of an ambassador-class starship in orbit...
Oh, dear.
Huh. This got more complicated, suddenly. Okay, there's Federation wreckage in orbit. We have a destroyed outpost. How did they not...
I mean, obviously, in the canon timeline, they had to have known it was a Romulan attack, because that's the whole basis of the Klingon Federation alliance in TNG. Is that the Klingons were like, man, you're...
Right, maybe what I'm saying is that they maybe not wouldn't have known about it, or they didn't, you know, find out, you know, later until, like, forensics came along and figured it out.
Yeah, maybe
maybe, like, a few years later.
Yeah, that could make sense.
I mean,
or maybe
that
they
being
just...
said, Klingons show up in Narendra 3, and they see the Enterprise C as space junk.
Maybe they just didn't know it was Romulans. Like, maybe the Romulans showed up and, like, blew everything up that could possibly have reported that it was a Romulan ship. And, you know, maybe the Klingons just don't have, like, because, you know, obviously if this was the crew of the Enterprise investigating this, they'd have figured it out lickety-split. But maybe the Klingons don't...
They didn't have the A-team then.
Yeah, maybe the Klingons don't spend as much time studying, like, you know, disruptor wave patterns and stuff. Maybe they're just like, something got blown up by something else.
I don't want to say Klingons are done with this or anything like that, but I think the first thing that they would come up with is that, oh man, the Federation launched an attack on Narendra 3.
That's possible.
Because there's a broken Federation starship in orbit. Narendra 3 isn't here. I mean, looks like they attacked the outpost, and maybe the outpost shot back and got the Enterprise, and their ships fled.
Yeah, that's I could see that too.
I mean, realistically, I mean, I personally probably would think that if I rolled up on, you know, one of my outposts that was just like destroyed and I saw the wreckage of another power starship in orbit.
Yep, I could see that. And speaking of Romulans, this episode also has an episode. I keep getting episode and movie mixed up. Star Trek VI also has some interesting implications for the Federation's relationship with the Romulans. And, like, basically, because it's easy to miss this plot point, but the Romulan ambassador is one of the people who are plotting to kill the Chancellor, kill the Federation president, and sabotage the peace process. And yep. It's kind of easy to see why. I mean, the Romulans are sitting pretty there with the Klingons and the Federation's always at each other's throats. And it's understandable why they wouldn't want an alliance to build there. But, like, it's kind of... The reason it's hard to figure out is that, like, there are numerous points in which there may or may not have been a Klingon-Romulan alliance.
Well, we know there was one in TOS.
We
know for a fact there was.
Yeah. We know that there was one in... And
that's about 30 years prior.
And however, there have been a number of times when the... Like, and that was the time when, like, when the Romulans showed up using a Klingon ship. And the assumption has always been that the Klingons gave the Romulans a bunch of ships, and the Romulans gave the Klingons a bunch of cloaking devices.
Mm-hmm.
That's always been the assumption, and it's pretty well backed up by the canon. The weird thing is that there are a number of sources that claim the alliance ended by 2292, which is, I think, a year before Star Trek VI is supposed to happen.
Do we know why?
No, it's never really stated. It's one of those things where they sort of triangulate it from. I think it's in the episode Reunion, Worf says something to the effect of the Romulans and the Klingons have been blood enemies for 100 years, and it's like measure.
Put it in like 2260s.
I don't know. Maybe it's not 100 years, but like he says it for some many years, and they measured back that many years, and we're like, oh, so it happened on this date. Personally, I think Worf's just not very good at history. You know, I like Worf. Worf is cool, especially on Deep Space Nine, but I just don't think history is his strong suit.
Right.
But regardless, you would think that if the Romulan ambassador was exposed as a member of the plot, which he was, that this would cause some serious repercussions, and may have led, and I would assume would lead to further hostilities.
That may have led to the Romulans just going to seclusion from the Federation and anyone else, because in...
just pull their heads back.
At the end of... Or is it the beginning? Is it the beginning of season two or the end of season one where we
are talking about Neutral Zone?
I am.
Oh, God. That's towards the end of season two.
The end of season two?
Yeah.
Really?
In fact, that may actually just be the end of season two.
The end of season two is season great.
Yeah, the end of season two.
Maybe in the beginning of season two.
Oh, yeah, it is the beginning, yeah, because it's right before, the first Borg incident.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, yeah, so go ahead. Yeah,
so in there we see, Picard and Riker and all them talking on the bridge, and no one has seen a Romulan for 80 years.
Yeah, they do say
that. And this is approximately 80 years after Star Trek VI.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair point. That
so
was
because of that, the Romulan's like, our bad guys, we'll go over here in the corner for a while.
We won't talk to you.
Yeah.
But the Romulan's in a timeout.
Because that math just about adds up, 2293.
It does.
Know, and the beginning of TNG is 2363.
Although that does raise some questions about the Treaty of Alderaan, because the Treaty of Alderaan must have happened some point in that time period.
2311.
Yeah, so it's there must have been some diplomatic contact for them to organize this treaty, and there must have been something to cause this treaty to be necessary.
Pen pals.
Pen pals. They're just writing back and forth. They're like, hey guys, we haven't had a treaty for a while.
Yeah, just, you know, a little subspace correspondence. It's all good.
Well, I could totally believe
the original canon, which, I mean, I think Enterprise has pretty much kind of erased this, you know, from history or whatnot.
Oh, goddammit, Enterprise.
The Earth-Romulan War was supposedly ended via subspace radio.
Right, well, because in the Earth-Romulan War, they were fighting very primitive spaceships that didn't have, like, magic view screens, and they never actually saw each other.
What's a phaser?
What is a phaser? They were using nukes.
They were nuclear weapons.
Man, that's a really great episode. That's Silent Enemy, isn't it? The first episode with the Romulans in TOS?
No, that's Balance of Terror.
Balance of Terror, yeah. That's a really good episode, and it's got like the guy who plays Sarek.
Submarine warfare.
Yeah, it's so cool. And that's that. I actually really love citing that episode as an example when people say that DS9 is too dark for Star Trek. I'm like, guys, did you ever watch The Balance of Terror?
Do you remember these things?
Look, people bring this up, and I'm like, they're like, because people in that who criticize DS9, they're like, yeah, but Sisko did a bad thing when he tricked the Romulans into the war. And it's like, well, you remember in that episode, Kirk intentionally lures the Romulan ship back to attack the Enterprise when it was retreating because he knows he can't catch up with it. So he intentionally lures it back with the intention of destroying it. Because he knows he can't allow it to get back to the Romulan Empire with all this knowledge of their defenses.
Right.
And it's like, oh look, Kirk did a thing that you could construe as being wrong for the greater good. So, you know, that's why I really love using that as an example when people are like, Star Trek characters have never done anything bad before DS9.
Right.
But, so anyway, that's an interesting implication for the relationship with the Romulans. And then, of course, you have this fairly minor note in the grand scheme of things, because we're talking about, you know, grand political maneuvers. What the heck is up with the Bird of Prey that can fire while cloaked? Why didn't they ever make another one of those? Did they seriously just not write down the plan somewhere? Were all of the technical schematics on the Bird of Prey when it exploded?
Maybe one of those footnotes of the treaty that they were trying to put together is that you can't produce these anymore.
That's cheating. No more cheating.
No more cheating. Well, I mean, Federation and the Romulans later had the Treaty of Alderaan, right? Maybe the Federation Klingons had it first, were like, hey, look, you can't have a ship that cloaks and can fire at the same time.
I suppose that's possible. Maybe. I was always a little...
It does seem to be like a strangely forgotten about thing, though, doesn't it?
It does. And, of course, they also completely... They never use the... Because their whole trick for finding the Bird of Prey while it's cloaked is to follow its exhaust trail. And, like, A, that seems like a fairly basic strategy. I mean, that's not really that hard to do. And, B, no one ever does it again against cloaked ships. Like, no one ever brings up that strategy, which has caused me and... I don't know if you've heard us talking about this, Bob, but some of our mutual friends have been discussing that being a Starfleet captain, one of the hazing rituals is that you have to figure out your own method for defeating a cloak. Because they never write any of this stuff down. Every time they run into a cloaked ship, they have to find a new way of defeating the cloak.
Interesting, like, Academy senior project.
How would you defeat a Romulan cloak?
After, like, command school or something?
I would fire a torpedo filled with flour. And I would just explode it. And wherever the flower is displaced. Which, like, speaking of which, isn't it, like, I'll buy that you can't actually detect a cloaked ship. What I want to know is why they didn't just start shooting at the places where torpedoes were, like, just appearing in space? Because, like, we see that the ship fires its torpedo and it briefly becomes visible. And it's like, well, you think that if you just waited for that and then just fired all your phasers in that general area, you'd eventually hit something.
Well, the Bird of Prey is probably in motion.
Yeah, I'd assume it is.
So it's moving around.
I'd assume it is, but you still have a pretty good chance, especially with two ships doing it. It just seems likely, but, you know. Instead, they had that little hilarious torpedo surgery sequence with McCoy and Spock, neither of whom are qualified to do that, I might add.
I really think the flash and the torpedo was actually more of a benefit for us.
Yeah.
As the audience.
It was a narrative device.
I mean, we want to talk about cloaked ships that can fire. Nemesis has the scimitar firing. You can't see that.
You just brought up Nemesis.
I did bring up Nemesis. Why would you?
Although in Nemesis, they actually do exactly what I was talking about, where they just start firing at the place where weapons fire is coming from.
I don't know. They just start firing at random.
Don't they target, like, the weapons fire discharges? I thought they did. They don't? They just start firing in all directions?
They just start firing. You clearly...
Picard,
Picard at one point, just like, hey, Worf, I want you to fire just all the phasers at just zero level... Zero plane declination, just fire in all directions. And sure enough, it's just a scene where it starts at the front of the ship, and phasers just start spouting around until they hit something.
Oh, dear.
And sure enough, the scimitar's sitting behind him, and, you know, he fires more torpedoes and crap back there and, you know, hits him a couple times, but...
The scimitar didn't care neither. Because that scimitar is apparently... God, I hate Nemesis so much. Everything about Nemesis makes me want to, I don't know, kill Rick.
And he has a perfect cloak.
Right, a perfect cloak. As opposed to, I guess, an imperfect cloak.
Yep.
How does your cloak get more perfect than we can't see you?
Well, I think, the cloak obviously has seen an evolution and whatnot, but I think that can be a conversation for another time.
Yeah. And so, anyway, so yeah, that's just a hilarious little side note with the Bird of Prey that can fire while cloaked. And then Star Trek VI is also very influential in terms of, it actually shows us a lot about the Klingon Empire, and kind of builds up what we're later going to see in TNG and DS9.
Oh, yeah.
Even though the Klingons, as it's been pointed out, the Klingons in Star Trek VI aren't quite like the Klingons in TNG, and who are more like, you know, the TNG era Klingons are like Vikings, and you know, and as was pointed out by SF Debris, the Klingons in Star Trek VI are kind of more like samurai. You know, they're much more restrained, and they still have kind of an aura of violence around them, especially Gorkon with his, like, giant, like, mammoth tooth skull, like, staff. I don't know what's up with that, his mammoth tooth staff.
I don't recall him having anything like that.
He totally has one of those things. Like, when he comes on board, he has this giant staff that looks like a mammoth tusk. It's a
you mean his little walking cane?
It's pretty big.
It wasn't really a staff. I mean, I remember he had, like, this walking cane thing.
Yeah, whatever.
That did look like it was the tooth of some sort of large animal that perhaps he, like, wrestled with the ground with his bare hands 20 years ago.
I think he was about to, like, stab someone through the chest with that thing.
I remember that thing. I don't remember a staff, though.
Oh, I thought it was a staff. I guess maybe it was too short to be a staff. But we also, I mean, there we see that, like, that Klingon titles are hereditary because Azit Bor, his daughter, becomes the Chancellor after he dies. And that's something we didn't know about Klingons before.
Despite the fact that later on we find out that women can't serve on the council.
Yeah, I don't know what that. I don't know how to reconcile those two things. I guess. I mean, granted,
society suddenly becomes misogynistic over the next 60 years.
I mean, like, granted, we have had some pretty weird, like, inconsistencies in our own political history. Like, there have been women who were elected to public office in the United States before women could vote. Like,
really?
Yeah, like I think the first congresswoman was elected before women could vote. Or maybe not a congresswoman, she was a Tennessee legislator, I think. I forget her name. But there was a woman elected to a state legislature perfectly legally, and women couldn't vote.
Huh.
But, like, they could apparently hold public office.
Interesting.
So I suppose it's technically possible that there's a rule that specifically says women can't serve on the council, but there's no rule that says they can't be high chancellor.
interesting.
I could see that being a possibility. But in that case, I mean, like, when Azit Bor is talking to her advisors, they clearly respect her, and they're not like, oh, you're a woman, you listen to me. So maybe she just has, maybe she's special for some reason. So that's a possibility. And we also find out that the Klingons are extremely fragmented, whereas before that, in TOS, they were mainly just sort of a united wall of evil. And Gold LeMay is what the Klingons were all about.
Yep.
But then they're going to build on that a lot in TNG with the Gowron Duras civil war, and in DS9 later with all the various political maneuverings. I really love Gowron and his political maneuverings. He's just such a funny looking Klingon. He has those huge bugged out eyes.
It's Robert Riley, is that the actor's name?
I think so. But I like him. He's one of my favorite Klingons.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we find out that about the Klingon Empire. So for that reason, Star Trek VI is very influential. We also find out that no Klingons have zero-G training. Because if you remember, they disable the Chancellor's ship's gravity. And then all these Klingons just floating around helplessly while these two Starfleet assassins beam over and...
In magnetic boots.
Yeah, and murder the Chancellor. It's like, you know, you guys still have energy weapons. You could still shoot them.
Perhaps you have heard the Russian fairy tale of Cinderella.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Chekhov.
If shoe fits, wear it. Chekhov, his feet.
And then, of course, there's that bizarre dinner scene. And I really like the dinner scene for the most part, but there's that bizarre moment when the Klingons claim Shakespeare. It's like you have heard it. You haven't heard Shakespeare until you've heard it in the original Klingon.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what the whole...
I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean. Maybe he just meant the original Klingon translation, and he's just saying our Shakespeare is better than your Shakespeare, or maybe they're claiming that Shakespeare was a Klingon.
Tach pech.
Yeah, which, granted, is a pretty cool thing to say.
Yeah.
And I did like all of the random Shakespeare quotes. That movie is full of Shakespeare quotes.
There's a movie coming out that's saying Shakespeare wasn't really actually a real person. No, not a real person, but didn't actually write any of the stuff.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Supposedly, I think the way the trailer goes is that it was actually some lord or noble that wrote it, and then had Shakespeare, like, claim credit for it because he wanted to see his stuff done on stage.
What? That doesn't make sense.
Well, because,
I
understand, like, if you're, like, you know, a noble or a king or something like that, you're not supposed to engage in that kind of activity where you're, like, on stage or performing or anything like that.
Oh, really?
That's my understanding, anyway.
I hadn't heard that. I mean, performing I could see. I guess, you know, granted, Shakespeare plays were considered a fairly low-brow form of entertainment, but then, like, Queen Elizabeth got all into them, and at that point they were okay. Because, you know, Queen Elizabeth says is cool, trust me. you do not want to go against Queen Elizabeth during that time period.
Yeah, I don't actually know if the movie is, like, saying, you know, like, legitimately that, you know,
yeah, Shakespeare didn't do stuff. Is it a documentary or a drama?
No, it's definitely playing like drama, but I don't know if it's based on, like, you know, quote-unquote true story, so.
Well, there have been a number of claims of whether or not Shakespeare, how much of Shakespeare's work he actually wrote. There have been a lot of claims that his wife wrote at least some of it, which I think it's fairly likely that there was a lot of collaboration. Seems unlikely that Shakespeare would have this big theater company and be the only one writing.
Yep.
But anyway,
the movie's going to be called Anonymous.
Anonymous.
Yep. Yep.
That has such hilarious connotations now.
Yep.
But regardless, we can be fairly certain that Shakespeare wasn't a Klingon, so we don't really know what's going on in that scene.
I think it was just an attempt on the like the writer's part to make the Klingon seem more sophisticated.
Yeah, I could see that.
Which I thought it worked really well. Mm-hmm. I mean, aside from the fact that it was Shakespeare.
Yeah, and
but
they, like,
there's more to Klingons than just being a warrior race, but they had, you know, like, art, culture, things poetry. Like that. Poetry.
And I really like that dinner scene. I especially love the fact that apparently that food that they're eating is food color, is like cold food colored lobster. And apparently the actors were all paid $100 for every bite that they took because it tasted so disgusting. It was, like, gross. And then, like, they were all offered, like, a big bonus if they would actually swallow some of it. And Shatner was the only one who would.
Really?
Really.
Huh.
This is the thing. It's amazing.
Oh, man,
you can look
great.
It up on Memory Alpha. So the dinner scene becomes so much more fun to watch after that. Granted, I liked it even before.
That was a whole new spin on one particular part of that scene where Uhura is trying to chat up one of the
generals,
and generals just like going to town, just like, I mean, like facing the plate, just like,
Did you know that, do you remember Chekhov's line where he says, guess who's coming to dinner?
Yeah.
Apparently, that was originally supposed to be Uhura's line.
Yeah.
And it was mm-hmm. changed because Nichelle Nichols really didn't like that, saying that line, because it's a reference to, I forget the name of the book, but it's a reference to a book in which a white father, like, says that as a, oh no, black people are coming over sort of thing. and that was an intentional reference, but I can see why it would make Nichelle Nichols kind of uncomfortable for that to be her character saying it.
A little bit,
it.
Yeah. I can see that.
But that was another thing I really liked about that dinner sequence, is that it shows that it's, like, the Federation is capable of prejudice. Which is another thing that some Star Trek fans will argue against, and they don't like the idea that the Federation can in any way discriminate or be anything less than, you know, perfect utopitarians.
Well, Asim Bohr also makes that, God, what's the word? That note, I guess you could say? Mm-hmm. Or observation.
The observation?
Observation at dinner, was by saying that the Federation is nothing but a humans-only club.
Homo sapiens-only club. Which is a little awkward, because Spock is standing right there.
Yep.
Granted, the movies weren't really very good at having a very speciesly diverse crew. There were very few aliens that we saw on the cruise. And in fact, I don't think it was really...
Speaking of which, the ones we saw were either being accused of crime or being discovered to be involved in a crime.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Because Truman Dax was an alien, and he was being accused because the boots were in his locker.
Mm-hmm.
And then... is that Valerius, who's the only other Vulcan on the ship, is then, like, found out to be one of, like, the co-conspirators.
I do love me some Valerius.
As all the humans are coming to the rescue.
Interestingly enough, a little trivia note, that was originally supposed to be Savick. And then they, for various reasons, chose not to do it, and make it a new character. And I'm not sure if that was if that was a good thing or a bad thing. It was kind
I like
of...
I like thinking that,
Yeah.
I like that it wasn't Savick doing that, because Savick really seemed like a very, by the book, pro-Federation kind of person.
Yeah.
That, was all about, you know, all the duties and responsibilities of being, you know, like, starship captain material.
See, I could have accepted it under a very important clause, is they would have had to show me Savick's motivation. And I could have seen Savick, the fact that David was murdered by Klingons right in front of her, in Star Trek III, I could have seen that being a change in Savick's character, and having her being so, like, messed up by her grief over that, especially repressing it like a Vulcan does, that she would establish this attitude.
Well, those characters didn't really have that much of a connection, though, in the first place.
Well, they, I mean, it's...
I mean, they were colleagues.
Yeah,
you know,
and it would have, they would have had to show me more than they did. is the thing. I could have seen something coming of that, but they would have had to devote a lot more screen time to the, you know, to this, to the character than they did. And I just don't think there was time for it.
I mean, even that being said, I didn't really see a whole lot of motivation of Valeris either.
Well, exactly. But, like, Valeris, it works okay with Valeris because she's a new character. We don't really know anything about her.
Yeah.
So we can fill in all the blanks. But as you said, with Savick, we've seen Savick. We know Savick at least fairly well.
Of the character I know to be Savick, I would never see her doing anything like that at all.
Right. And so if it was going to be Savick, they would have to work much harder to establish why she suddenly done this big 180 in terms of her character's outlook on life.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one hand, it would have been cool to have another recurring character, but on the other hand, I think it probably... I don't think they had the time to do it right.
Well, they changed it because Robin Curtis didn't want to come back, right? Who was playing Savick in...
No, actually, apparently Robin Curtis was never asked.
Really?
Nope. According to Memory Alpha, anyway, which supposedly gets its information from interviews and the DVD extras, supposedly Robin Curtis was never asked to be Savick again. There's a lot of different like... Gene Roddenberry supposedly said he didn't like the idea. The actress who originally ended up playing Valeris supposedly said that she didn't want to be the third actress to play Savick.
Well, yeah, because they already had Christy Alley.
Yeah. Supposedly.
In Subject 2, and yeah. Then she didn't come back for whatever reason. No. I don't really actually know why.
Well, as I understand it, the big thing was that she was just too famous. Like, her salary would have been way too expensive. They couldn't afford it.
Okay, so they couldn't afford her. And then Robin Curtis comes along. I thought Robin Curtis did a pretty good job.
Yeah, I thought she did fine.
I mean, and that I would have liked to have seen more of Robin Curtis. I think she did a really good job.
I was sad that she didn't. That I was hoping that she was going to be a major character in Star Trek IV. but, you know, then she just showed up to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Which made me kind of sad. She wasn't even in the big hearing section at the end, was she?
I don't recall seeing her
there. I don't
remember
her there either. That made me sad. Maybe she just wasn't available for that much shooting. And speaking of Star Trek IV, it's kind of interesting to look at the lead-up to Star Trek VI in terms of what's been happening before.
There will be no peace as long as Kirk lives.
I really love that scene in Star Trek IV when the ambassador gives that ultimatum. And then, of course, before that, the reason for this being you have this conflict between Kirk and a bird of prey, which... From what I could tell, the captain was acting on his own. He didn't seem like he was under orders from the Klingon government. But the Klingons seem to... there are a lot of rogue elements within the Klingon government, and it seems like they were using that as... like, even if the captain...
From what I understand, how the Klingon Empire is divided up is that you have the actual Imperial Klingon fleet.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, under the jurisdiction of, like, the Chancellor or whoever their, you know, appropriate, like, Department of Defense type person is. And then there's... all the houses that have their own, like, ships and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So, for Krug, I think he would probably be just a part of his own house or something.
Yeah.
That's what I think his deal was. So, that being said, it's really, really hard to manage diplomatic relations for an empire.
When you have so many different parties working.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so I think how they were thinking is that under whatever Klingons decide to do, they're just going to do it. That being said, if you're not a Klingon and these people are doing things, you're just going to have to be okay with it.
You're just going to have to accept it.
You're just going to have to be okay with it. Otherwise, there's going to be problems. And
it's
we're
also,
not going to care. We're just going to kill you.
I also think the Klingon ambassador might have been employing some hyperbole because he was probably just mad about Genesis. And so he was like trying
Genesis
to,
was a pretty big deal.
And he was just playing that all up with the whole, Kirk stole our ship and killed its crew. I'm so mad about this death of loss of life because I would seem crass if I was just yelling at them about Genesis.
Well, Sarek comes in that scene. It was like, hey, by the way, did you know that you killed the sun and the Enterprise is destroyed?
Well, also, you blew up USS Grissom. Like,
and you blew up the Grissom.
The Federation doesn't seem terribly upset about that. Like, you know, Savick brings it up, or Sarek brings it up, but, like, the Federation isn't, like, saying, like, we demand reparations for the loss of our science ship and you have to apologize. No one, I guess USS Grissom was kind of a loser ship. It was a very
poor
unpopular. The Oberth class is so sad. It's got like doesn't even have any rear facing weapons. It's got the one torpedo and two phasers in the front. So sad to be an Oberth.
Yep.
I really kind of have to wonder why they even bothered giving it weapons because it's so underpowered. I feel like maybe they could use that space for something else.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't know when the last time you saw like a deep sea marine ship, like a deep sea research ship having like a cannon on the front. They usually just don't bother. It's kind of a waste of space.
You gotta shoot those whales.
Well, you know, harpoons for that. And then, of course, you have... And this is, like, the really weird kind of fly in the... Because, like, Star Trek 2, 3, 4, and 6 all fit together very nicely. Then you have Star Trek 5, and it, like, completely messes up the timeline. And it's like, what's going on in Star Trek 5? Because apparently... Because, like, if you disclude Star Trek 5, you can go with Gene Roddenberry's idea that the USS Enterprise A was not a new ship. It was a refurbished USS Yorktown.
Yorktown. I thought it was Lexington, but apparently Yorktown.
Yeah, Yorktown. That was Roddenberry's idea. And it makes sense, because the, you know, the Constitution class at that point had been said to be, you know, they were being retired out of service. And as Roddenberry points out, it doesn't make sense that Starfleet would make this brand new ship and then retire it, like, 5 years later.
Yep. Especially in that span of time.
Yeah, and it's
I mean, it's like they literally just got back, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with Star Trek 4, I mean, when did they actually find out the Enterprise blew up?
In Star Trek 3? I mean, I don't actually remember exactly. I didn't look up the dates in Star Trek 3, but it can't have been more than a couple... It can't have been more than 6 months.
At most.
Like, it was not a long time. Yeah. So, like, they must have already... The only way that it could possibly have been a new ship was if they were already building one.
And then they just decided to call it the Enterprise. They just slapped
the Enterprise label on it.
Yep.
But again, it seems unlikely that they would just build a new Constitution class if they were already retiring them from service at that point.
Yep.
And
Star Trek 5, so which is a year later, right, after Star Trek 4, for what was on the sideline? Yeah.
Apparently it took them a year to work out all the bugs.
Well, they're still working out. No, all the bugs haven't worked out yet. They're still working out bugs after a year. Man. Which I think lends more credence to the fact that the ship was already old. It was having problems, instead of being a new ship with problems.
Yeah. Especially since the Yorktown is one of the ships they listed as being, like, disabled by the probe. By the space probe.
Really?
Yeah. well, that was why Roddenberry came up with the idea. Because he was like, the refurbished USS Yorktown, and the Yorktown is one of the ships that they mention. And I could see him taking a year to fix all the problems that being, you know, having your power systems wrecked by a giant log in space would have. And then, of course, Star Trek V also shows the planet of intergalactic peace, which is like...
With the Romulans, Klingons, and Federation.
Right, which is like... never comes up in Star Trek VI. They never mention it, and it's like it's not hard to see why, considering how abysmal. I mean,
Nimitz
looks
like it's a desert planet to me.
Yeah, it just kind of throws this, and like that's another encounter with the Klingons that like ends very peacefully, and Kirk's like whole issues with them aren't even in there. Like, you know, you never see Kirk's hatred of Klingons in Star Trek V that you see in Star Trek VI.
Which is kind of peculiar.
Yeah, which is just, again, which is why it throws this weird wrench into the timeline.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the lesson is we're all better off forgetting Star Trek V ever happened. It's like, no, guys, no. Not, we're not even going to deal with that.
For whatever reason, Spock had to beam over and shoot God.
Yeah, that part is just so sad, because Spock is a character that always avoids, like, that kind of wanton violence. And, like, you know, they invented the Vulcan neck pinch so that Spock wouldn't have to bludgeon a guy unconscious with a phaser. Because that's just not Spock. Spock's not all about, like, brute combat. And he's like, no, I'm going to shoot this giant alien with a disruptor rifle, with a disruptor on a Klingon ship.
Yep.
And, of course, right before that, they hid from a torpedo explosion behind some rocks.
Yep.
That's right up there with Indiana Jones surviving an atomic blast inside a
refrigerator. Lined with lead, mind you.
Yeah, lead-lined. Because that would totally protect you being, like, flung up into the air.
Yep.
That's a thing.
It's too legit.
All right. So, that is, I think I'm about ready to bring this discussion to its ending point.
Yeah, we were a lot of places with that.
We were. Well, because, you know, we're talking about the...
How all these things are connected together is just really fascinating to think about.
Yeah, and especially because so much of this is all speculation, because of how little factual canon information there is, which is why there totally needs to be a show set in that time period, right after Star Trek VI, but before The Next Generation. Needs to happen. Hey, Mr. David Foster, in charge of the next show. If you're hearing this, you can use that idea. I won't even charge you for it. All right. So next week we are going to be talking about, or at least if Bob is okay with this, I didn't run this by him because we're doing this live.
We always do it live.
We're going to be talking about the different doctors of Star Trek and comparing their characters and their methods.
Intriguing.
Intriguing? I've always thought so, because, for the most part, the doctors on, like, they're, like, you know, McCoy is, like, the quirkiest character on TOS, and, like, the holographic doctor is also really quirky.
Fantastic idea. Tell me about it next week.
All right. Cool. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye, guys.
Signing off.